Hello, and welcome to this CME activity. This is the first in our three-part series entitled Primary Care Playbook Podcast, Advancing COVID-19 Prophylaxis in Community Practice. This program is brought to you by PER and is supported by an educational grant from Shinoe. My name is Chuck Vega, and I'm a clinical professor of family medicine here at the University of California at Irvine, where I'm also an assistant dean in the medical school. And I'm very excited today to be joined by a real expert in this field, Dr. Stefan Grabenstein. Would you mind introducing yourself?
Hi, I'm Stefan Grabenstein. I'm a professor of medicine, chief of the Division of Geriatric and Palliative Medicine at Brown University, and a vaccine researcher, especially in the long-term care space.
Excellent. So we have the primary care and more of the expert. It should be a great dialogue. Thanks again for joining us today. In today's discussion, we're going to be examining the ongoing burden of COVID-19 in high-risk populations specifically. We're talking about barriers to prevention and treatment with this population and exploring the emerging roles of both pre-exposure and post-exposure prophylaxis for COVID-19. And I thought we could start with just a real basic overview of epidemiology, because it's not something a lot of us in clinical practice have front of mind these days. We have an endemic infection now. It has faded in terms of the severity of infection as we go through different Omicron variants that generally we see less hospitalizations, and fewer folks are coming to clinics like mine, a safety net clinic in Santa Ana, California. Looking at test positivity these days, rates is one way to track the illness. They're about 1%. But in terms of percent of ER visits that are due to COVID-19, it's well under 1% these days. The hospitalization rate, the death rate, also well under 1%. But I would call out that even last year, in summer 2025, we did see a spike in hospitalization rates. We saw a spike in death rates. So this is something that has continued to circulate. And so it's time to think, I think, beyond just hospitalizations and mortality when it comes to COVID-19. I think a lot about its effects on individuals in other ways. And maybe, Stefan, you could talk about some of those issues.
Yeah. And I think there's one other aside to throw in here. And that is, when we talk about the COVID infection rate, we are increasingly underestimating the actual Sure. amount of COVID out there. And that began sort of at the beginning of the Omicron era when tests became available for at-home use. So there's plenty of people who are getting infected now that no longer report. So the actual activity in the background is more than I think we give it credit for. A second feature is that even among people who are asymptomatic, a fair proportion will have so asymptomatic means they don't have COVID. COVID is SARS-CoV-2 infection with disease. If you're asymptomatic, then technically you don't have COVID, even if you're infected. So my point here is that even among those people who are asymptomatic, anywhere from a third to 40% will have radiographic changes in their lungs, suggesting that there's actually disease happening in the background that we are missing. And so I don't want to overstate the importance of COVID. What I do want to say is I think there's a lot more there than we give it credit for. So to your question specifically, there are certain subsets of people who have greater risk of worse outcomes. And so this is not an equitably distributed disease. If you are in a low-income category, if you make a lot more money, if you're a high-income category, how the disease impacts you is actually quite different. In the lowest income category, it is two-thirds or better likely to affect your mobility, your usual activities, ability to do your usual thing, the likelihood of having anxiety or depression. So there's a special group of people that I think we have to think about whom COVID affects differently, and those are the individuals with low income. If you're in the low income group, you have a greater than a two-thirds probability of having reductions in mobility and in usual activities in daily living. And you're also impacted, not quite to that extent, in self-care and in the way you experience pain and discomfort. So I think it's relevant to say that we have to pay attention to this and also not minimize when somebody comes in with symptoms, even if they're minor, about whether this might be COVID or COVID-related outcomes. A second point is when COVID, when the acute infection is over, still a substantial proportion of individuals will have later impact, which we call post-acute sequelae of COVID-19 or long COVID or a host of other different names. Long COVID is actually relatively common, anywhere from 5 to 30% in the U.S., and in some countries, even 40 or 50% might have late sequelae of a COVID infection. When we talk about what late sequelae are, that's usually, in most places, they're talking about symptoms that either appear or persist after 2 months from the initial infection. If you look at also how that goes across our country, it doesn't affect the reported long COVID varies across the country by state.
Yeah, I think the good news when it comes to long COVID, because that's definitely one of the issues that I see in my practice, I've never had the higher rates here in Orange County, California, nothing approaching 30 or 40%. And with Omicron, we know that long COVID is not, so hospitalizations, mortality is lower over the last several years. So are the rates of long COVID, but it still happens. It's estimated to affect about 3% of adults. And there is a geographic distribution. Unfortunately, in the southern United States, long COVID is still more common. And I will also just pick up on your points regarding low-income populations. It's the same thing that I see, in data that we've known that historically COVID has disproportionately and negatively affected people of color. And that's more about social determinants of health. Were they, availability of vaccines, availability of quality care, and very importantly, an increased number of comorbid conditions, which we've always known, things like advancing age, but the higher number of comorbid conditions you have, the higher the risk of complications of COVID-19. And those are particularly issues around hospitalization and death. And I still see them as pertinent, along with vaccination, as major risk factors. And those are the folks who want to protect the most, along with those who are immunocompromised, those in long-term care facilities, pregnancy. I think those risk factors are still very pertinent today, and as a whole, comprise something that is at least approaches, if not is, a majority of the population.
Yeah, and I think so. Long COVID is an outcome of the initial infection, and the risk is variable depending on underlying immunity, whether it's vaccine or prior infection, but every round of infection increases that risk for long COVID. And it also can drive cardiovascular disease. And if you have severe cardiovascular disease, your risk for it is greater than among others.
Yeah. So unfortunately, there's a cyclical relationship there between COVID-19 and really any significant infection, be it urosepsis or a bad case of influenza, and outcomes like cardiovascular outcomes. And so that's what I use, practically speaking, to when I talk to my patients about the vaccine is, when you have heart failure and a history of stroke, I mean, you are talking about a higher risk of those events. You are talking long COVID in of itself could produce higher risk of those events, could produce even higher risk of things like mast cell steatotic liver disease. So I try to, frame this as more than just this episode of a upper respiratory infection with COVID. It is significant risk. And so that's a conversation I have regularly with patients about who are considering vaccination. But now it's also going to play into pre-exposure and post-exposure prophylaxis as well.
Right. And how sick you get with that initial infection increases your risk for long COVID. And how sick you get with that initial infection is also dependent on the number of underlying conditions you have. Whether it's cardiovascular or otherwise. So these things sort of pile on as risk factors. Age by itself is also a risk factor for more severe disease, including both hospitalization and death, even though in the last year or two, the death risk has gone down quite a bit. The hospitalization risk has remained.
And I'll just call out for pregnancy, COVID and during pregnancy is associated with a higher risk of pneumonia for the mother. It's higher, associated with a higher risk of preterm delivery. So both a risk for both mother and baby in that population. And then in long-term care facilities, and we don't have to think back that far to see, you know, really the absolute horror and the crisis that we faced in 2020, 2021 in long-term care facilities. And unfortunately, I think one thing that we haven't learned is just that, you know, the importance of vaccination among that population. We look at residents in long-term care facilities, they're under-vaccinated, and workers in those facilities also under-vaccinated. We're taking away an important primary protection for those who are really at the highest risk.
Yeah, and you know, so you were talking about 2020. In that first 6 months of COVID, a third of all the people that died in the country were in long-term care facilities. And that group makes up only 1% of the population. A second sort of statistic was that during those first 6 months, the most dangerous profession in this country was working in a long-term care facility. So that's changed now with the advent of vaccination. But in the last couple of years, vaccine acceptance has started going down again. So it's gradually changing the risk profile, both of getting infected in the first place and also becoming more and more distanced from that primary immunity that might protect you from reinfection. It's reemerging as a risk. It puts us in a position where if vaccine isn't accepted, what other strategies might you have to avert those more severe outcomes? And in nursing home residents, of course, it's most acute, but also in all the other settings.
Right. So, yeah, I really promote vaccination. It is really the number one way to limit the impact of COVID-19 right now. I do think that there's still something to be said for routine measures as well, that, when you're sick, stay home, really try to emphasize those issues as well. We know that uptake of medications, particularly as outpatients for COVID-19 medications, has not been very great. Because I think a lot of patients really see this as kind of a DIY illness now. They just want to take, you know, they're probably not even going to test at home with an antigen test. They're certainly not coming in and getting a PCR test. And when you have diabetes, COPD, heart failure, and a history of stroke, you know, and you're 82, you know, that starts to be a risky proposition. I want to know, as your PCP, I want to know early, because with all antivirals, the earlier you start them, the better it's going to be. But there is a psychology around this now, unfortunately. And, you know, it's still a tough healthcare system to access. Do you want to go wait in line at the ED for, you know, 7 hours? Do you want to go to an urgent care center that's out of your, insurance coverage? You may be paying a significant out-of-pocket cost, particularly for older adults. That can be a real challenge. So there's a host. It's not just psychology. There's some really practical barriers to getting good care these days. And that's why I think the concept of pre and post exposure prophylaxis is really important. Any other barriers you want to mention, Dr. Grabenstein, that you see in your neck of the woods that you find impactful?
So there's two things that I think about. Well, probably more than two, but one of them is the recognition of the disease that COVID causes and how it distinguishes itself from the other respiratory infections. And I think when people realize that this is really a different infection altogether, it changes their attitude about what they worry about. So one example is that the SARS-CoV-2 virus is a systemic infection, not just a respiratory infection, even though the name suggests this is just respiratory. This virus gets into the bloodstream. It binds to cells that have ACE2 receptors. Those are the endothelial cells in the lining of the blood vessels everywhere in the brain and the kidneys. The reason it takes a few days before you start shedding and can test is because it probably goes systemic first most of the time and then gets expressed in the mucosas after that. So you have to wait till it's expressed. If you look at the GI excretion of the virus, that happens usually before you turn positive in the respiratory secretions. And after the respiratory secretions no longer test positive, you still have it in the GI, in the fecal samples for sometimes days or weeks, and kids on average 3 weeks after that initial infection, long after the respiratory samples test negative. In the nursing home setting, that sort of profile of shedding also means that there is a risk for transmission from person to person, potentially, that is bigger than what we sometimes give it credit for. So from an environment standpoint, to me, the nursing home, the residents in nursing homes are like the canaries in the coal mine.
Right.
When we think about transmission, what happens in the nursing home, because there's close contact, lots of opportunity, many different people, visitors who come from the outside, no ways to actually quarantine them from the outside world, it's going to keep getting introduced. So you have an environment that's ripe for transmission. And yes, we actually know that masks work, but it's really hard to get people to wear masks.
Right.
You can have rules about if you don't get your vaccine, wear a mask, but it's still really hard to get people to wear masks. Vaccines work. But even when vaccines work, quote unquote work, means different things to different people.
Right.
It doesn't mean you don't get infected. It just means right. you don't get as sick. And if you get infected despite vaccination, you can still potentially develop an infection where you can transmit it to others. I'm an example of that. During COVID, I got infected. I'm one of those people who's almost hyper-vaccinated. I think I'd been 4 or 5 vaccines in when I got infected. And I was watching my, in a very OCD kind of way, my antigen titers, because I would do this antigen test on a daily basis, look how bright the stripe was and how quickly it developed. And by day 7, it disappeared. And so by day 10, I said, okay, I'm good. And then the stripe started reappearing again. I didn't become symptomatic, and I transmitted it to my wife around day 14. Long after.
That's not good for domestic tranquility.
I can tell you, she was a no.
You'll hold that over you for a long, long time.
And hadn't had a prior infection at all. And I was cavalier about thinking about how I was no longer at risk, but I actually gave it to her during the rebound. And so in a nursing home, you know, when we have a time-based way to take people off of quarantine, we overlook the idea that the time-based thing doesn't quite do the job if you still have 30% shedding at 7 days out. And even if just a few of those are still transmitting, it only takes a few to propagate an outbreak through the facility to affect other residents, all of whom have multiple high-risk conditions for severe outcomes. So the barriers are not having barriers, you know, not being willing to wear a mask, not willing to do social distancing when it occurs. And that's true whether it's in the nursing home or in a home setting or anyplace else. It's not getting vaccinated. So our healthcare workers in the nursing home setting, if we have a 20-30% vaccination rate for COVID, that's pretty high. And that's pretty abysmal if you want them to be one of the barriers for getting it into the facility in the first place. And they're the ones that have the most face-to-face contact, direct patient interaction. And then you can't keep the family members out, and they may be unwilling to wear masks or be careful. So you have lots of opportunity for it to come in. So it is a place to think about how do you do transmission. And that means if the masks aren't going to work, and if the vaccines are inadequate, whether it's because of acceptance or because they're just not working well, or because you don't keep them quarantined long enough when they become infected anyhow, even if that person won't get that sick, you really need to have another strategy to figure out how to stop viral replication and transmission, and perhaps the person who's getting it, keep them from having downstream consequences like long COVID.
Yeah, very well. That's a great setup for moving on to the next section. Let's be more proactive and let's think about how we could prevent infection, particularly among those with the highest risk, those who are immunocompromised, those in long-term care facilities, those who are older and have multiple chronic conditions and have not been vaccinated and won't wear a mask. I always feel like I'm just kind of adding up these risks every time I assess a patient with an upper respiratory infection. So let's first focus on pre-exposure prophylaxis, a medication which could prevent the onset of COVID-19, of symptomatic or asymptomatic COVID-19 that's given before patients are even exposed to someone else. Now, we are familiar with the use of PrEP for things like HIV. Since it's not even a new concept when we think about PrEP for SARS-CoV-2, we've had monoclonal antibodies that were approved in 2021, but unfortunately, these antibodies lost efficacy as all of our, you know, routine monoclonal antibodies did over time, and they were pulled in terms of the EU, the emergency use authorization for those antibodies in 2023 in the United States and then 2025 in Europe. And so there are some options now, though, that are emerging as a potential PrEP. One is called Pemivibart. This is PrEP for adults and adolescents with immunocompromise. So this is and it's given as an IV dose, 4,500 milligrams, 90 days apart. It showed in previous research that it was effective against the JN1 variant. That was dominant back in 2024. They used immunobridging analyses to determine that it was effective. But I think one real downside here was that there was a high rate of hypersensitivity reactions along the lines of 8%. With anaphylaxis occurring in 0.6%. Several of those cases of anaphylaxis were quite serious and had sequelae. There has been another study. This is from Canopy, the phase 3 trial, using that same dose of pemivibart versus placebo. There was a significant risk reduction in terms of those folks with immunocompromise who received it, in terms of acquiring symptomatic COVID-19, along the lines of 74% to 84%. And so this does seem like, it could be a good option. But it is intravenous. There is that risk of side effects. There is an investigational agent right now known as VYD2311. It actually shares the same structural backbone as pemivibart and another, antiviral as well. It could promote greater neutralization of SARS-CoV-2 as a virus. And right now they have a phase 3 trial going with over 1,700 patients enrolled. Now, this one is dosed differently and probably more conveniently for a patient, does not require an IV infusion. It's administered monthly. They're testing a series of IM injections given monthly over 3 months, and that's a placebo-controlled trial. So there's more to come in this space. But Dr. Gravenstein, I'll pause and get your comments on PrEP for COVID-19, where we've been and where we might go.
Yeah, I think in general, the literature is getting more and more interesting in drugs that potentially can provide some added benefit. And there's no doubt, since we know that individuals at high risk for severe disease are at high risk for often multiple reasons, not just because of underlying conditions, but because maybe they didn't respond to the vaccine well, or maybe they can't get out of situations where they're going to get exposed to infections. So having something that protects them season long, like the transplant patients, the cancer patients, and so forth, I think is really a game changer for that group.
I would, that's absolutely right. And I think it's worth spending just a moment to note that if you have a patient who's, undergoing active treatment with chemotherapy, if they have a history of organ transplant, they've studied the immune reactions, and especially after the first dose of the SARS-CoV-2 vaccine, it is much weaker compared to the immune response you'd expect in someone who has a regular immune system among adults. So the second dose does get you closer, so boosting is really important for those folks, but it's still significantly lower. There's a significant difference between folks who are transplant recipients and getting active treatment for cancer. So those are special groups to watch out for, because we know the vaccine's not going to be as effective. So that's kind of where we are with pre-exposure prophylaxis. What about post-exposure prophylaxis? These are for folks who have had a known COVID-19 exposure. And so again, we previously have used monoclonal antibodies, carisomab and devimab, bamlanivimab with atacivimab. They were indicated previously, but they're not effective against Omicron variants. And then there's been a host of drugs that have been repurposed with the concept of, hopefully, prevention of symptomatic disease after exposure to SARS-CoV-2, and they really haven't worked out. So really we're kind of left with what we have. And what we have is we have antivirals that can be effective, but they're generally underused. One of the principal ones we use in the outpatient setting, which is very much underused as treatment, is nirmatrelvir boosted by ritonavir. And so this drug, we know that among symptomatic folks, it can cut symptoms by about a day. But they actually have tested nirmatrelvir, ritonavir in as PrEP But it didn't work. So a study published in New England Journal of Medicine showed that it was not more effective than placebo in prevention of household transmission of SARS-CoV-2 in terms of symptomatic disease. It was well tolerated. The side effect rate was similar to that of placebo. But I think one thing that's notable about this study was that the overall rates of transmission were very low. Coming into the study, over 90% of the population had evidence of either through vaccination or active infection or probably some combination thereof for most folks. They had evidence of some kind of immune response prior to getting the PrEP. And so I think that limited the power of the study to detect a difference because the rates of transmission were fairly low. Dr. Grabenstein, any comments on nirmatrelvir with ritonavir?
Yeah, I think especially more recent studies are harder. You know, when early yeah. in the pandemic, when these first studies were done where it really looked like it was quite effective, people were afraid of COVID and they would show up with much earlier in their symptoms. And I think studies that are done now, people might sit on their symptoms a little before they show up thinking that it might be clear and maybe it's not COVID and they don't bother to test. So showing efficacy if you give it too late is much, much harder.
Absolutely. So again, time is of the essence with these antivirals, for sure.
And I think in both cases, you suppress viral replication. So you even if you don't reduce transmission, you do buy the immune system a little bit more time to complete the protection and suppress the rest of replication. So I think there's still a role for them. It's just not... in real world sort of application, it's just a little harder to get that added benefit.
And when we look at these trials of post-exposure prophylaxis, we're really looking at, you know, a general population, not a specific population in a long-term care facility or that have immunocompromised. So there's more data coming on those populations who really need it. But this is just more for it's also really important to get an idea of how effective these drugs can be in the general population, because there's another one I want to mention as well. This is ensitrelvir. So this is a 3-CL protease inhibitor. That protease is necessary for replication of SARS-CoV-2. Now, this one's already been approved for treatment of COVID-19 in Japan and Singapore, but it is on the fast track of the FDA for treatment and post-exposure prophylaxis in COVID-19. So in terms of a study of treatment using ensitrelvir, and this involved how many patients? It was over 1,000 patients, and they're treated with ensitrelvir, either 125 milligrams or 250 milligrams, and 5 days of treatment compared with placebo. And there they were looking for, this is for folks with the infection, they were looking for time to resolution. And the nice thing here is that it's very easy for us in primary care to remember that when you use an antiviral and you get it promptly on board, you can make patients' symptoms better by about a day. So, and that's the same for the anti-influenza drugs as it is for our anti-COVID agents. And so, that's pretty easy to remember. It makes the discussion, I think, fairly easy as well. So I think but that day can be really important when you have a big deadline at work or you're trying to get your kid back to school, et cetera. All those things can make a difference, and they do add up. I also think that it's kind of remarkable in these trials that, you know, we're talking about symptoms are going on 9 or 10 days. And that's just a long time. That really starts to add up in terms of lost productivity, you know, time away from your family. So I think those things really do matter. And then I'll just close with the Scorpio post-exposure prophylaxis trial. So this is just being published now. And it studied nearly 2,400 household contacts of persons infected with COVID-19. Again, ensitrelvir versus placebo. This was 125 milligrams of ensitrelvir, 5 days, and it had to be given within 3 days of contact of where the patient developed symptoms. So, you know, taking it a week after the contact was not allowed. And it did show that there was a significant reduction in terms of symptomatic COVID-19 in those household contacts. The hazard ratio was 0.33. So there's about a 2/3 reduction versus placebo in the transmission of COVID-19. Side effects, again, were similar in the placebo and ensitrelvir group. I think that another thing to note among folks who are older and therefore at higher risk for complications of COVID-19, ensitrelvir was even more effective. There, it was about 3/4 improvement in terms of the risk of symptomatic COVID-19 among those household contacts versus placebo. And there were no COVID-19 hospitalizations or deaths in the study. So those outcomes really weren't applicable. I think this is pretty remarkable stuff. It kind of speaks to me again. Yes, I always put things in context of, you know, what I already know from, from other examples of illness. Here, I think about it, it's kind of similar to what we could do with prophylaxis against flu among household contacts. That is also, if you use oseltamivir, use baloxavir, those are very effective, but they're underutilized. And with that, Dr. Grabenstein, I'll pull you back in. What do you think about the data? Anything that really jumps out at you?
Yeah, just two things. And I want to make sure the audience hears what Scorpio study was. This is post-exposure prophylaxis. So this means that there's somebody in the household who becomes symptomatic. And within 3 days of that person becoming symptomatic, the other household members get drug or get placebo. And in those contacts, the likelihood of developing COVID was cut by about 2/3. So this is keeping them from becoming symptomatic in a household where somebody can spread it. So that's in the same ballpark as those early studies with oseltamivir and zanamivir for influenza. I think the other thing that I'd like to say is there isn't a get out of jail free card. With these antivirals, there's always other things you worry about, drug-drug interactions and so forth. And with ensitrelvir, it does have moderate drug-drug interactions with tacrolimus. So in our transplant patients, it's an issue because it's a moderately strong CYP3A inhibitor, and it's a PGP inhibitor. So you can increase the tacrolimus exposure roughly threefold, with effects lasting about a week or so after the antiviral is stopped. So just keep that in mind.
Do you think it has the same degree? Because that was one of the big things that that held me back from prescribing more nimetrelvir with ritonavir. It was the ritonavir component that promoted all those drug-drug interactions. Do you see it to that same degree with ensitrelvir or less so?
My sense is that this is much less with this drug, but
that's my sense too. Yeah. Okay. Good. We're on the same page then. Well, so I think, in terms of our conclusions, so there is hope, and we are looking forward to having more tools in our toolbox. So just as there are many ways that patients might be at higher risk for COVID-19 as complications, including prolonged COVID, including the risk of hospitalization and mortality, particularly among those of the most frail of our patients. I think the concept of using pre-exposure prophylaxis and particularly post-exposure prophylaxis really is going to play a significant role in the coming years with this as the infection continues to go forward and change. With that, Dr. Grabenstein, any other takeaways that you want to highlight from today's session?
Yeah, I think one key thing that we said early on that I will say in a slightly different way is we're not quite done with COVID. The mutations that took us from the original wild-type strain, which we called Wuhan for a while, through Omicron, the number of mutations that happened between those various steps through Delta and so forth were one or two at a time until we hit Omicron. Then it was 20 at once. And since Omicron, through JN1 and KP2 and so forth, again, it's been typically just a few mutations at a time until this past year, with the Cicada strain, where we had a jump of 20. So as far as I can tell, we still have room for the SARS-CoV-2 virus to run and to mess up our lives. So the second thing is that whether you have vaccines or antivirals or whatever it is, they don't work if you don't use them. So get your vaccine. And with your patients, especially if they have high-risk conditions, if they don't show up with their early on in the course of their illness, they won't get benefits from antivirals that we have available to offer, so that you can't sit on them. I know with the providers in my practice, Even though we're all geriatricians, they forget this too. They say, you're not sick enough. But yet they're already of age to put them at high risk for severe complications. And they have not been often offering access to an antiviral that might mediate the outcome where they can't possibly know how it'll be until they actually wait. So you don't want to wait to figure out if they're going to get that sick. Right. You want to get in on the intervention early.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, when we talk about antivirals or not antibiotics, we're not as worried about resistance. So there's a, in terms of a stewardship aspect, I can say we underuse our antivirals, broadly. We have a ways to go. In fact, patients with influenza are more symptomatic influenza are more likely to receive an antibiotic, bad, not helpful, versus an antiviral, which could help them out. It is an exciting place to be, and I think there's going to be a lot more to come in the coming months. And in fact, there's going to be more to come in this three-part series of podcasts. So on our next discussion, there's going to be a deeper dive into patient selection and shared decision-making around prevention strategies. Thanks very much, Dr. Gramstein, for your outstanding contributions to this program. And thanks especially to our audience. We know that you're all very busy, so it means a lot that you took the time to share this with us. This activity, as a reminder, is brought to you by PER. Be sure to complete the post-activity evaluation and claim your CME credit. For more resources, you can go to PER.com. We'll see you there. Take care, everyone.